You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. First, climate change was coming. Now it's here in storms, rising seas, and much more. Our guest, Mark Hertzgard, first came to my attention with his late 1990s book, Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. That came after a quest of many years to find our impact on the natural world. Since then, I've read Mark's leading-edge work in Vanity Fair, Newsweek, The New Yorker, and in his current post as environmental reporter for The Nation magazine. Mark Hertzgard, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
I appreciate you finding the time. You've been extra busy lately, published not just in The Nation, but also your December 10th article in Newsweek. That's a good place to jump in. What has climate change got to do with pasta?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to say this for my beloved 7-year-old daughter. The piece that ran in Newsweek that you're referring to is called The End of Pasta, because of what climate change threatens to do to wheat. And, of course, pasta is made from wheat. And when I was describing this story one evening to a fellow journalist who was over visiting and giving him the 30-second elevator pitch for it, I neglected to notice that my 7-year-old was off in the corner there, and turned out that she was listening more closely than I thought, and she said, "No, Dad, you can't have the end of pasta. After all, I am Italian." And because she's Italian-American. And so I told her that, that's why I wrote this article, so that we can try to prevent the end of pasta, because, you know, there is still an awful lot that we can do if we get started quickly and act very, very urgently. There's a lot we can do, not only to protect wheat and therefore pasta for mac and cheese-loving little kids all over America and around the world, for that matter, but also things that we can do to prepare our communities for the amount of climate change that is now unstoppable, and to prevent that amount of climate change from being unsurvivable. There is, unfortunately, an awful lot of inertia in the climate system that we cannot prevent. There are going to be increasing difficulties in the years ahead, but we need to work very rapidly now to keep those difficulties relatively manageable.
Well, you know, I've talked with Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, and he's warning for every 1 degree rise in temperature, we'd expect about a 10% drop in world grain production. And now it seems like everybody from Kevin Anderson to the World Bank is warning a 4 degree rise is maybe the new normal by 2050. So doesn't that lead to some horrible math for a world expecting to feed 9 billion people?
It does if we let that 4 degrees happen. So we simply can't do that. If we allow 4 degrees centigrade of temperature rise in this century, that will basically create a situation where civilization as we know it will not survive. Not least because when you have a 4 degree C temperature rise, some of the impacts that would unleash, such as melting vast stores of methane that are underneath the tundra in Russia and Upper Canada, that would create a situation where global warming becomes, in effect, irreversible. And so we simply can't allow that to happen, it seems to me. I mean, again, I say this as the father of a 7-year-old, and it really does change your perspective on that. You were kind enough to mention Earth Odyssey. When I wrote Earth Odyssey in the 90s, I wasn't a dad. And, in fact, in my new book, Hot, I talk about how, in the very first paragraph, about when I was traveling around the world in the 90s, like most international journalists, I've seen a lot of terrible things happen to kill children, but they were always other people's children. And when it's your kid, there is something different that kicks in. And so that was what led me to write the book Hot, because my daughter had just been born when I was on assignment for Vanity Fair right after Hurricane Katrina, and went to London and learned from the chief science advisor of the British government, Sir David King, that we were now, as a planet, already locked into a significant amount of climate change over the next 50 years, even if we act very quickly. And so the challenge, Alex, really is to keep that 4 degrees C temperature rise from happening. There is, we've already had 1 degree C from the amount of greenhouse gases that are already up there. We've desperately got to keep that to the minimum amount possible.
Well, let's get specific. What's happening with wheat, say, in the United States?
Yes, for this story for Newsweek, I went out to North Dakota, which who knew? But North Dakota is where some of the best pasta in the world begins. They happen to have just the right, or have had, I should say, just the right set of climatic conditions to grow some of the best durum wheat in the world, which, just parenthetically, most wheat in the world is used to make bread. But durum wheat is what you use to make pasta. And already in the last 30 to 40 years, the pasta wheat growing area in North Dakota has been dramatically shifted by climate change. You used to be able to grow durum throughout the state of North Dakota, and over the last 30 years, that has shifted. The growing zone has shifted west. And so the eastern half of North Dakota, almost no durum is grown now. Now it's grown in the western half and even into eastern Montana and the neighboring region in Canada. Ironically, one of the things that that means is that the durum zone, by climate change, has pushed the durum growing zone into the very area of North Dakota, Montana, Canada, where there is now one of the biggest oil booms in recent history underway, the Bakken oil boom out there. And so that was a remarkable thing for me to see as a reporter, to go out and talk to the durum wheat producers out there and to see their land now being taken over by oil drilling and natural gas drilling, which, of course, is only going to make climate change worse. So you see both sides of the problem there. You know, it's not just in North Dakota. We've already seen over the last 50 years, the temperature rise of the last 50 years has already reduced globally, has reduced wheat production by about 5.5% from what it would otherwise have been. So, you know, these impacts are happening now. They are projected to get much worse unless we act very, very rapidly to get off of fossil fuels and onto the clean, green economy of the 21st century.
Well, with this drought and with floods in other parts of the world, like Great Britain, we're already seeing rising food prices. But we saw a more violent and immediate threat in Hurricane Sandy. Congress almost failed to pass legislation to help rebuild New York and New Jersey after the storm. What do you make of that?
Well, during the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations, the House of Representatives, the Republican leadership there, declined to take up that bill to provide even relief to the New York, New Jersey area. They got such a political backlash, including from fellow Republicans like Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, that now they've backtracked and the Republican leadership will allow a vote. But I think the larger point here is that, unfortunately, the United States is still very, very far behind the rest of the world in its, what I like to call, the social capital response. You know, as we prepare for climate change, lots of the interest and focus is on technical questions and physical infrastructure. Can we build a seawall around New York City to protect it against sea level rise and storms? And that's all important. But really, the most important is the question of social capital. What kind of a society do you have? Do you have a society that believes in science, that values science, that believes in government, that is willing to be taxed in order to pay for public services? And when I was writing my book, Hot, about how to deal with the next 50 years of climate change, I went and spent quite a bit of time in the Netherlands, which, of course, has been dealing with these issues for many, many years because they're such a low-lying coastal country. And one of the greatest advantages that the Dutch have is that they do have that kind of social capital. They believe in science. They believe in government. They believe in collective action. They are willing to pay taxes, and they trust their government to invest those taxes properly to defend the nation against storms and flooding and so forth. That is what is really lacking in the United States, and nowhere more than in the Republican Party, which, very unfortunately from a climate perspective, the Republican Party continues to be able, inside of Capitol Hill, to block most important initiatives here. And unfortunately, we saw that in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
Well, yeah, but the Republicans paid for it in the recent elections with the Latino vote. What did you find out about people of color and climate?
Yeah, that was such a remarkable development. I wrote about that in The Nation. I think it's one of the real unsung positive developments out of 2012. And you're right. I think that even before that happened, that Hurricane Sandy had a real impact on the presidential race, despite Barack Obama's shameful silence on the issue for most of the campaign. But then Mother Nature itself spoke up and said, okay, you know, climate change is here and it's real. But aside from the president's silence, I think he still benefited because, as you mentioned, Latinos and other groups, but especially Latinos, voted for Obama at almost a 75 to 25% preference over Mitt Romney. And part of that, of course, was Romney making very insensitive remarks about immigration. For example, during the Republican primaries, he urged that Hispanics self-deport to solve the immigration issue. But it was also a matter of the environment. And it's oftentimes misunderstood. People tend to think of the environment and climate change in particular as an issue that that's those Prius-driving, upper-middle-class, white environmentalists. Well, in fact, the data shows, and especially here in California where I live, that Latinos and almost as much African-Americans, Asian-Americans, and especially youth of all races, they care about climate change very, very much. In fact, there's an enormous gap on the climate issue for Latinos. They support action on this, including government action. It's not just that they believe that climate change is real. They want the government to do something about it by astonishing margins, 20% to 80%. Only 20% of Latinos are not concerned about this. And in the 2012 election, Latinos and youth in particular and these other groups that I mentioned, they voted in large numbers. And so this is a very encouraging thing going forward if, and this is a big if the mainstream environmental movement can recognize this fact and respond accordingly. Because traditionally and frankly for too long, the U.S. environmental movement has been dominated by, you know, very well-meaning, but white, upper-middle-class people who are older and who see issues of environmental justice as something that, you know, it's nice and they should do it and it's the right thing to do. And what they really need to understand is that, no, this is the future of the environmental movement. You're not doing these people any favors. They're the ones who are going to be doing a favor for you, because if environmentalists want to win in the United States, they need to put Latinos and blacks and Asian Americans at the front of the movement and to find ways to deal with those issues, not just as one political consultant says, you can't just talk about butterflies. You've got to talk about jobs, because, you know, it's Latinos and African Americans and others. They're the ones who generally are living closest to the coal-fired power plants, the oil refineries, and all the other pollutants that are killing them on a daily basis, not just the long-term dangers of climate change.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with one of the premier environmental journalists of the English language, author and commentator Mark Hertzgard. His latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark, you have said we have to stop climate change, but we also have to live through it. How are we going to do that? What strategies would you offer our listeners to adapt to the big changes that are coming?
Well, that's a tough one, Alex. That's the whole focus of that book, Hot, so it's hard to crystallize it into a few words, but I'll say a few things. First, that book is 80% about solutions. You know, we know what the problem is now, so let's really get focused on the solutions. The smartest thing I heard, and this came from leaders all over the world, not just in the Netherlands, but also here in the United States, there are some impressive people, and in Britain, those are the real leaders on this, that our goal has to be to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. So there's two parts to coping with climate change now. On the one hand, we have absolutely got to, as we discussed earlier in this broadcast, keep the temperature rise at a minimum. We have to avoid unmanageable amounts of temperature rise. We cannot survive a 4 degrees C temperature rise on this planet. So we've got to do everything we can to get off of fossil fuels and halt deforestation and change our agricultural system. And by the way, there's a lot of very good things happening there. Don't believe this nonsense that, oh, we can't do it. And for that, I refer listeners to what's going on in Germany. And there's a new book about the, as they call it in German, the Energiewende, which is the energy turn, the big turn that Germany is making. They are leaving behind fossil fuels. And by 2030, all of their electricity will be coming from non-carbon sources. And that, by the way, comes from the third biggest economy in the world, the world's leading export nation, the economic superpower of Europe. The Germans have decided to do that. And by the way, they're being led by a center-right political party now. So this is not a left-right political issue. So that's the first thing. But then, getting to the core of your question, the other challenge is we must manage the unavoidable. Even if we keep temperature rise to 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, there's going to be a lot of impacts. Look at the impacts we're already seeing today with only 1 degree of rise. Hurricane Sandy, the terrible floods in Pakistan a year and a half ago that put 14 million people out of their homes. 14 million people in one of the most conflict-prone and nuclear trigger-happy regions of the world. So we've got to prepare for that. And the ways to do that are many, but it will take money. And it takes social organization. We've got to manage the unavoidable. And there are things that you can do, even in one of the happiest and most uplifting parts of Hot, told the story of how some of the poorest people in the world, farmers in Western Africa, are already adapting to climate change. Even though they don't know that term, they're adapting to climate change by planting more trees and bushes in their fields, and that is increasing their productivity, agricultural productivity, because when you plant trees and bushes, it means that your fields are relatively cooler because of the shade, and it means that your soil is able to absorb what little rain they get there instead of the rain flashing off. So there's many things you can do. The Dutch, of course, are the world leaders in this. They have been building sea defenses and river dikes, but also changing how they govern themselves. And one example that I tell in the book Hot was how they had decided, okay, we're going to be getting more downpours, but also more drought. So what are we going to do? Well, they decided that they would take this area that was now a huge field. I went out to look at it, and they were going to turn it into a lake. And so this lake, when the River Rhine was overflowing, the flooding would be contained by diverting that water into this field and turning it into a lake. And then that water would then be available for drinking and so forth in the event of drought. And I said to the government official who's leading me around, I said, well, that all sounds very well, but look, here's all these farmers who have this land. What about them? And he said, oh, don't worry. They will be bought out. We'll give them a fair price for their land, and you know, they'll be fine. And I said, well, what if they don't want to be bought out? And he looked at me as if that were a very American question, which it was. And he said, we have discussed this issue repeatedly over 4 years, from the local level to the regional level to the national level and back down again. It has been decided that this is what we need to do. And at the end of the day, you cannot allow two or three people to get in the way of what is good for everyone. And that, Alex, is what I mean about social capital. That ability for a society to realize that, no, we have to do what's best for all of us, that collective action is going to be necessary in these cases, and a transparency, a democratic process to be sure, but in the end, you act. And contrast that to other places I went for this book, like in Louisiana and Florida, which are, of course, prime targets for hurricanes, and where that sort of action is literally inconceivable because of the sacred nature of private property in those political and cultural contexts. You know, in Louisiana, they did not even have a building code. They did not have a statewide building code prior to Hurricane Katrina. And why not? Well, as was explained to me, because that would be socialism. You're talking about government planning, that's socialism. Well, of course, it's nothing of the sort, but that's the kind of difference that is going to be very problematic, frankly, for Florida and a lot of the American South that still holds to those ideas about the individual and government is always bad. Although, isn't it funny that, you know, when you get hit, then suddenly the opponents of big government suddenly change their minds. You saw this with Representative Peter King of New York lambasting the Republican leadership for ignoring and failing to take a vote right after the fiscal cliff stuff to give Hurricane Sandy relief. You know, when it's their people that are getting hurt, oh, then it's unconscionable that big government doesn't step in. When it's other people, you know, they're on their own. You know, we got that big deficit we got to worry about. So that kind of attitude is something that is very troublesome, I think, for the United States. And so for listeners, I would say that, you know, you want to make sure that your community is a community that works together, where people are closely knit and checking in on one another, and that you've got a government that works and that is willing and able to tax itself responsibly, prudently, and deliver on those taxes. But that's what we're going to need, is a lot more of that kind of effort going forward.
Well, Mark Hertzgard, where can people find out more about this book and about your ongoing writing?
Very simple. I have a website, markhertzgard.com, and I'll just remind folks it's a double A, as my Norwegian ancestors would be proud to say. And people who are interested, you know, you can buy hot there and any other place. But I'd also just put in a quick plug as well for a group that I'm trying to start with some others called Climate Parents. And we're trying to organize parents and, for that matter, grandparents to finally speak out and get active on climate change. We find it just baffling that, given the stakes for what all of us hold most dear, which is our children, and, you know, my daughter Kiara is why I wrote Hot. It's astonishing to us that parents have been so quiet for so long about climate change, and we want to change that. And if you'd like to join us, please go to climateparents.org and let us know.
Well, you've hit me. I'm a parent, and I really care about what happens to my kids, and I'm hoping that'll be a wave that spreads around the world. We have been lucky to spend some time with one of the power minds on climate change, investigative green journalist Mark Hertzgard. You can read his columns in The Nation magazine and in many others. Mark's latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Find his website at markhertzgard.com, and I'll put links to this interview in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Mark, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.